Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. That is www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Welcome to Between the Beltways, a political podcast series from the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Each month, your hosts, Dr. Deepan Chatterjee and Dr. Shreyasi Deb, will explore the races that will shape the central Maryland counties of Howard, Montgomery, and Prince George's in the upcoming midterm elections.
Welcome to the sixth episode of Between the Beltways. Here's your host, Deepan Chatterjee.
Hi, this is Shreyasi Deb.
And our guest today is Steve Bolan, who's running for office as a state delegate in District 9A in Howard County. Steve grew up in Michigan, where he learned to appreciate the outdoors, hiking, camping, and playing on the Great Lakes. After following a career in school, he decided to live in Howard County with his wife, Linda. Steve worked in federal service for 27 years. Steve's passion for learning, science, and technology led him to pursue higher education, and he completed a doctoral degree in electrical engineering. He has published in professional journals and has peer-reviewed numerous technical publications as well. As a recognized expert in his field, he has been invited to speak at international conferences and to participate as a scientist in international earth science projects. So welcome, Steve, and congratulations on winning your primary in June.
I would like to add Linda's here as well. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much for inviting me to do the podcast, and I really appreciate it, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to your audience.
All right. Okay. So my first question to you is, what made you decide to run for office this year? Can you tell us a little bit about your background in public service and why you want to be the next state delegate for District 9A?
Yeah, sure. So, as you said in your opening, I'm a proud, patriotic, 27-year veteran of federal service. In fact, my wife and I both left federal service last year. We both retired with nearly six decades of federal service between the two of us.
So it's more than 27 years. I think I found that on the online somewhere.
60 between the two, 27 for me, and I'll let you do the math on
it. Oh, I see. Okay. Got it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we were both compelled to serve our country. We both know what commitment, self-sacrifice, and devotion to causes and struggles greater than our own means and what it's all about. We've both been on the front lines defending democracy and our American way of life. And just because we retired from federal service last year doesn't mean that our need and desire to serve country and community has ended. We still have those deep passions to reach out and to lift up those who are struggling and those who need our help the most. And we think we can do that by serving the people of Maryland at the State House, in the State Capitol.
Okay.
So congratulations on the primary. So who are your key opponents in the general election?
Well, thank you for the question. And I like the question because it's fair and balanced. And I believe in our democracy and that we need to have fair and balanced discussions about topics and issues. And the fact that you would ask me about my opponents, I appreciate that. My opponents are incumbents. One of them is Trent Kittleman, and the other one is Warren Miller. And I also have to say that I do respect people in public service. I respect their commitment and their desire to want to serve our community. So I have nothing personal with them or anyone else who's running. But I think we might have disagreements in policy and how we want to move Maryland forward. But with that said, I also think that we can hold on to our core values and beliefs, but still come together as a community to do good for Maryland, because there might be people not only in the opposition party that I disagree with, but there might also be people in my own party that I might disagree with. So the disagreements are okay, and they're healthy in a democracy, and we need to have different points of view and diversity of backgrounds so that we can come together to build better, stronger solutions.
Okay, that's an excellent answer. So what are some issues that you think are relevant to your district?
Well, there's a few. And I also like to point out that I'm not the type of person that likes to point fingers. The past is behind us, the future is ahead of us, and we have to come together today as a community to figure out what we want to do to make our tomorrow better. But there's a few things as I get out in the community and talk to people. And what's on their mind, what I find out that what's on their mind is, one of the big things is development. And I don't have to get into all the issues because we know what's been going on the last few weeks and few months with development in our communities. And here's the thing, we need to have some development because we need to keep our community strong and vibrant and growing. We also have to make sure that we're growing in ways that respect the taxpayer, protect the environment, and preserve our rural and historical heritages. So development has to be fair and balanced, but it also has to take into account our infrastructure needs. We need to make sure our roads and bridges are keeping up. We need to make sure our hospitals and medical services are keeping up, and that our first responders are keeping up, and that our school systems are keeping up, and that we're not overloading our schools. So it's about making sure we do development. We have to stop the practice of develop first, fix later. We have to think first and develop in fair, smart, and sustainable ways that benefit everyone.
Okay.
So, and I do have a couple more points.
Sure, absolutely.
And so the next thing is healthcare. So there's a saying that nobody gets out of life alive. Well, nobody gets out of life without needing medical care at some point in their lives, too. We all need it. We're all going to need that. Doesn't matter how old you are or how young you are or where you work or where you live, at some point you're going to need to see a doctor. And we have to make sure that everybody can see a doctor when they need to see a doctor and that it's affordable for them to do that. We also have to make sure that people have access to mental health care and drug addiction care as well and to affordable prescription drugs. And with mental health care and drug addiction care, we have to realize that those aren't crimes, and that people who are suffering under these afflictions need the help and need the dignity and respect that they deserve to get the help that they need. Because I guarantee nobody wakes up in the morning today saying that I'm going to develop a mental health issue on purpose, like anxiety or depression, or I'm purposely going to become addicted to a substance. Because it can happen to any one of us, and it does happen to a lot of us. So we need to make sure that we're treating people with the dignity and respect they deserve and to treat them. And then the next thing is we need to help our children. And by doing that, we need to make sure they get the right start in life. It's a very competitive world out there, and we all know that. It's not like when we were growing up as kids 10, 20, 40 years ago. It's very competitive out there. And one of the best things we can do for them is to give them a great education to get started. And to give them the best education we can give them, we need to give them the best teachers that we can give them. And to do that, we need to attract and keep the best teachers we possibly can. And that means recognizing teachers as the highly skilled professional people that they are. The other thing is that, and this is no secret, and we have to talk about tough issues too, so I'll bring up a tough issue. Is that we need to make sure that our schools are safe. And we all know what I mean by that. We all watch the news. And that means safe from gun violence. And I am sure that even my opponents and people in opposition can agree to that. We might have different ideas about how that would look and what we would need to do. We have to make sure that our schools are safe places to learn. It's not just the gun violence, but it's safe from bullying, discrimination, and other things. Our kids are there to learn, our teachers are there to teach them, and we need to make sure we have a safe, conducive learning environment for our children. And then the last thing is, and I tell people this all the time, that I want to breathe clean air, drink clean water, live on clean ground, and eat clean food like everybody else. And I can't imagine anybody telling me that they don't want to breathe clean air, and if they do, they're free to contact me. I have a website and Facebook, they're free to contact me. But we want to live in a clean environment. It's what the one thing that we can hand down to our children is a clean, healthy environment. And the last part of that is that I think Maryland, it's about time that we start getting serious about building a clean energy economy. We have the wealth in this state, we have the technology, infrastructure in the state, we have the industrial base in the state. And my parents always used to tell me, where there's a will, there's a way. well, my gosh, let's have Maryland have the will and show the rest of the world the way to building a clean energy economy. Mm-hmm. So those are the things I'm passionate about, making sure we're developing smart ways that benefit everybody, making sure that we all have access to affordable health care, including mental health care, addiction health care, and prescription drugs, making sure that our children have the best education that we can give them, and making sure that we're doing proper and right, keeping our environment clean for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So your emphasis on mental health care is, you know, welcome to my ears, because I'm a clinical psychologist by profession, and I can, you know, I can definitely vouch for the fact that mental health is, although in law it is supposed to be at parity with physical health, it's not treated in the same way. There's still a lot of stigma among people. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. So you touched on three key areas that President Trump is trying to make policy on. You touched on safety in schools. That was sort of thrust on our, it's been going on, but it keeps getting thrust on in unfortunate ways. And then the environmental policies that this administration is trying to bring in. They are trying to work on health policy in some ways. You touched on all of those. What do you think of President Trump and his job performance so far?
Well, here's the thing. After serving my country for 27 years, I'm a patriot. I consider myself an American citizen and a patriot. Mm-hmm. And my standards of ethics, transparency, and accountability extend to all of our elected leaders, whether they're the President of the United States, the Governor of Maryland, or a state delegate. And one of the things that concerns me, and I'll bring up an example right away about needing responsible government, is that I understand that Mr. Trump will be meeting with the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, here
tomorrow.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I, as an American taxpayer, would like to know what the purpose of the trip is, what's the objective, and what are the expected outcomes that are supposed to be a benefit to our country. Because I'd like to know that my taxpayer dollars are being well spent for this trip. But moreover, I also understand from reporting that he is planning to meet in private with Putin. Mm-hmm. And that is just their translators and themselves only. And as an American citizen and a patriot, I'm appalled by such a secret meeting. And I would expect that any American citizen would expect any president to be transparent with us with the meeting of any foreign head of state. And I'm not saying that our president can't and shouldn't meet with foreign heads of state. They certainly should, but they should document that in some way and let us know, the American people know, what's being said. Because here's the thing. This argument isn't about any one president, and it's not about any past president, what they've done or not done, or what political camp they've fallen into. Mm-hmm. It's really about the standards of ethics, transparency, and accountability that apply equally across all levels of government, political affiliation, and all elected officials, past, present, and future. As you see, if we allow the standards bar to be lowered to meet every transgression of civic and ethical misconduct, then we would soon end up with no bar at all. And that would mean a government that doesn't listen to us or respond to us. And if we go down that road and we don't demand transparency and accountability in our government officials, then we start running the risk of devolving into a country that's ruled by tyrants, despots, and dictators. And I tell you, we've put too much sweat, toil, tears, and blood has been shed for this country to allow that to happen. So I would demand that Mr. Trump give us a full accountability of his meeting with Mr. Putin and the spirit of transparency and our democratic American way of life. And like I said, this transcends Mr. Trump. It really extends to all of our political elected officials. But being that he's doing this with Putin tomorrow, it's very topical to point out to our president that he should be accountable and transparent to the American people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for raising the point. It's very important for all of us to be responsible and accountable at this time.
Right. So my next question to you then is, who are your heroes in life?
Well, so I have to start off by first saying that I deeply admire, respect, and appreciate my wife. There are many things that were missing in my life before I met her, and there are many things in life that I'm doing now that I would not be able to do without her. Mm-hmm. But I think about the people in my lives and the heroes in my lives, in my life, I have to honestly say that my parents, my mom and dad were my heroes. Mm-hmm. Both farm-raised teachers who grew up in Iowa during the Great Depression and World War II. Mm-hmm. Both taught me the values of hard work, your word is your bond, and to think on your own. And I remember back at times, both being teachers, that we did not grow up rich by any stretch of the imagination. But I never felt like I was missing or wanting for anything, because they gave me the most important things that a child could have, and that was their love and their support. Mm-hmm. And I also remember them working second jobs many times to make ends meet, but not only to provide for their family, but I remember my dad buying school supplies, pencils, pens, erasers, and notebooks for his own students who were lacking. And I remember my mother buying fruits, apples, bananas, and oranges to bring into her students. Mm-hmm. And my wife's mother is a teacher and has similar experiences. So I admire the passion to their profession and wanting to help their students as much as they help their own family. And I'll just tell you one last thing, is that we all have, when we grow up as children and become teenagers, we all have conflicts with our parents at one time or another. Mm-hmm. But we all grow up and we all look back and we find out just how smart and wise our parents really were. But I had another thing that struck me about my parents. And after I became an adult and started working on my own and sacrificing and learning the meaning of self-sacrifice for causes and loved ones, it struck me just how deeply my parents loved us and how deeply they supported us. And that's more than just knowing how smart or how wise they were, but it really struck me just how much they loved us. So that's why my parents are probably my biggest heroes. And they're still living today. They're in their mid-80s. And still tell them every day how much I love them. And I encourage other people to do the same thing with their parents.
Marylanders? Are they here?
So my parents both live up in Pennsylvania, not too far away. So we get a chance to visit them every once in a while. Unfortunately, my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, lives in Los Angeles, so we don't get to see her as much as we would like to, but we call her quite frequently on the phone. And my father-in-law has passed away, but he's still in our hearts, dear to our hearts.
So one of the unique things of this episode is that Linda has joined us. Not to put you in a spot, but did you want to comment on anything that we are discussing? I would really like to pull you in because you've so gracefully joined us today.
So my wife is a very shy person.
Well, I think naturally I would say that this campaign, it's the first time we've ever attempted to do anything like this, and it has been such a tremendous, tremendous experience for both of us, and a real eye-opener. We've met people across the community that we never would have anticipated meeting otherwise. We've been invited to some very special events within the Muslim community, for example. And I respect my husband's role in all of this tremendously. I've seen him work extremely hard and do so very well. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's talking to voters as well as out in the public forum. And I'm just excited about what the future might bring us.
Absolutely. That's great. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Really appreciate that.
So one of our traditions in Between the Beltways is that we end our episodes with a slow-going rapid-fire where we have questions, little tidbit of questions. So I do have those, and I would like both of you to respond to those.
Oh, okay.
So my first question is, what is your favorite food?
So that's easy for me because it's pizza with everything on it. But I haven't had pizza with everything on it for a very long time because my wife has this crazy idea about keeping me healthy and fit so we can have a long, healthy, happy life together. Go figure.
Sure. Linda?
And so my favorite food is a salad, a very healthy salad with all the fixings, the vegetables, and whatnot. That's what I enjoy.
So you see what we eat. It.
So you eat salads,
right.
Not pizza.
Yes.
So what is your favorite restaurant in Howard County?
Well, so mine are Glory Days and Kelsey, and both here in Ellicott City, both favorite stopping places of ours. And I don't know, since we both go out quite a bit together, I don't know, Linda, what...
Well, I would say a couple of my favorite restaurants are just a little bit further afield, but still in Columbia. One of them is the Seasons Grill down at Columbia Mall, mm-hmm. which I'm very fond of, as well as the Ale House in Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, these are all our favorites as well.
We've been to several, and Kelsey's is definitely on my top list of favorite places.
And then the last question to both of you is there anything that you would like to mention that we, our listeners, would want to hear from you, but we haven't discussed already?
So I can get started with this one, too, and then give Lynn a chance to think about it. But I grew up in Michigan. So mm-hmm. I'm an alumni of Michigan State University, and mm-hmm. I'm a big football, basketball fan. So I tell my wife all the time that during football season, unless you're a Michigan State football supporter, we can't be friends. But of course, with the election season coming in November, I can suspend that rule for anybody who would like to vote for me, who is not a Michigan State alumni and football supporter. But I love basketball and love football.
Wonderful.
Well, I would only add that as a UCLA graduate, I'm a big fan of the Bruins. So I think it's fairly fortunate, perhaps, that the Bruins and Michigan State don't play all that frequently.
Right.
Or there would be like a war in the house.
Yes, right, right. Right.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Steve. And Linda, thank you for joining us. It was really enjoyable to have you as our guest.
Well, we thank you guys very much for the community service, for having a podcast and getting messages for candidates out there so voters can look and see what candidates stand for and what they what their policies are. I think this is very extremely important to our democratic process that voters know where candidates stand on the issues. And that's both people running for and incumbents alike. So thank you guys for your community service.
Sure.
That was surely our idea behind starting our podcast. So thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Linda, thanks so much for joining us.
And we'll be right back.
July is coming to a close. It's time to shop Target for your back-to-school needs. Save on kids' shoes, backpacks, and more. Order online, free shipping on orders $35 or more. Target, expect more than ever before. Low prices today and every day on thousands of items. ShopTarget.com.
Hey, welcome back to episode 6 of Between the Beltways. Our last episode was recorded right before the Maryland primaries that were held on June 26th. So we are going to do a rundown of the interesting local races. We begin with one right next door to us in Ellicott City, Howard County Council District 1, where political newcomer Liz Walsh, who's running for office for the first time, an engineer, running on development issues and how that brought about the Ellicott City floods and things like that. She had a major victory over incumbent Howard County Councilman John Weinstein. Walsh gained 2 votes in the recount and Weinstein lost 2. The race was one of the closest in recent county history and will mean that the next 5-member county council in Howard County to be installed in December will have all new members. So Liz Walsh is now going to face Raj Katoria, who's a Republican. So by the end of the reporting period in June, the interesting part is that Walsh, as I mentioned earlier, is running for the first time. She had roughly $2,000 in her campaign chest, while John Weinstein, who's the incumbent, had over $70,000. So this sort of reflects the trend we are seeing across the country where newcomers, women who are sort of left of center, are upsetting elections along against longtime established incumbents. It reminds us of 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose race has been much discussed in the press ever since she won over 10-time incumbent Joe Crowley, who was sort of expected to be named to the seat for Nancy Pelosi as probably the Speaker of the House eventually. So since Alexandria won, she has raised more than $800,000 in her campaign chest. Deepan, how do you think this will play out in the general election?
So one interesting thing, what you were talking about, the race was so close. Liz Walsh had, at the end of the count, 3,175 votes, and John Weinstein had 3,169 votes, so just 6-vote difference in the final total. So that shows you why every single vote counts. For those people who say it's not important to vote, or, you know, I don't think my vote will matter. Every single vote counts. Okay, so having said that, I think this is an interesting trend that we are seeing. We saw it in New York, the 14th Congressional District, as you spoke about. We are seeing it in local races here in Howard County and other counties in Maryland. The Baltimore County executive race, I believe, was also very close. So is the Montgomery County race for executive. So there is an increasing trend that I see a lot of not just center-left, but I think very left, people who call themselves democratic socialists,
yes,
are actually winning elections. The Bernie Sanders wing of the party is ascendant. And I think that's good for the Democratic Party, because for a long time, we've had people like Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, more centrist Democrats, take on the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate. And I feel like, and this is again a personal opinion of mine, that they're not doing an effective enough job in terms of fighting this current administration and its policies. And I think this we need a more diverse, more young, energetic bunch of people on the left, show more passion. And I've been talking about this for a long time, and I think that's happening. And I'm really happy to see that. It's akin to the Tea Party movement on the right, that happened when Obama was president in the early 2010s and so on. Hence, this is good for the Democratic Party, in my opinion. So in the gubernatorial race, the primaries that were held on the 26th of June, Ben Jealous, who is, again, from the Bernie Sanders School of Politics, won. The former head of the NAACP, actually the youngest ever chairperson of the NAACP, won, beating Rashaan Baker, the PG County executive. And Ben Jealous' running mate is Susan Turnbull. And he beat him handedly by 10 percentage points. So Jealous and Turnbull are running on a number of interesting issues, very, very democratic socialist issues, if you will. Things like single-payer health care, Medicare for all, tuition-free college. And right after he won, when the reporters asked him what would it be like beating Hogan in the general election, he said, well, you tell us beating Hogan is like beating Everest? Well, we just climbed K2, he said, referring to the world's second highest mountain. And if you can climb K2, you can certainly climb Mount Everest. So I like that attitude from Mr. Jealous. And if Mr. Jealous was elected, Mr. Jealous and Ms. Turnbull, if they were elected as governor and lieutenant governor, he would be the first African-American governor of Maryland. And his campaign has so far provided a stark contrast from Hogan, both in terms of policy and style. And I think his administration would do the same if he were elected. And the only stumbling block is Hogan's enduring popularity, which makes him pretty popular in a pretty blue state as a Republican. So he's a pretty formidable opponent, even in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. Recent polls have shown as many as a quarter of Maryland Democrats who intend to support Hogan in spite of Ben Jealous's historic win in the June primaries. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm hoping that this will be a tough fight. And the last election, if I remember correctly, Larry Hogan won by only 5 percentage points against Anthony Brown. So it's not unthinkable for Mr. Jealous to overcome that deficit. So the Cook Political Report on July 10th released a poll saying that the Maryland gubernatorial race is likely Republican. And then the Real Clear Politics average, the poll average taken between February and June of a variety of polls, suggests that Hogan is leading Ben Jealous by 14 points. However, there have been no significant polls or good polls after the primary. So we'll see if these polls come out. I'm sure in the next 3 months we'll have more polling, and then we'll be able to report on those polls to give you a better idea of where Mr. Jealous stands against Mr. Hogan. So as I have already talked about the Baltimore County and Montgomery County executive races, I think the races are going to be extremely close in the midterms. So on that note, Shreyasi, do you think that this 2018 November will be a wave election for the Democrats?
Well, one thing I sort of want to tag on to what you were saying is that this cycle, at least in the primaries right now, there are certainly things that we are seeing that are very interesting. You mentioned that if elected, Mr. Jealous will be the first African-American governor of Maryland. Here in Howard County, the Democratic nominee, Dr. Calvin Ball, if he is elected, then he'll be the first African-American county executive in Howard County.
Right.
And then there are women, first-time runners, Liz Walsh, we mentioned here at home in Ellicott City, and then Alexandria, we mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. But even women who've been in office, look at Martha McSally, Republican in Arizona, look at other Republican women. There are lots of Republican women also who are running, many of them for the first time. I think it's going to be very interesting for first-timers. Now, that I mentioned because that might have something to do with who gets elected and whether we really have a wave election year. I'm not sure that Democrats will win as many seats as Republicans did in 2010. I still remember President Obama coming out the next morning talking to the press and mentioning shellacking. One reason for that is that we have extremely gerrymandered districts, so Republicans are already in place in Republican-heavy districts, Democrats are already in place in Democrat-heavy districts. The interesting ones to watch will be the open seats where a number of Republicans have already announced that they are going to be retiring. Those are the ones that we are going to watch. And I am really, really excited again for the newcomers, for women, for people of color who thought that they have to do something and they are now running for elected office.
All right, so that was the sixth episode of Between the Beltways. We thank you for joining us. And just a programming note, we'll be taking off in August because of the congressional recess, and we'll be back in September again. Thank you.
This has been Between the Beltways, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Find it each month on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.aois21.com. Keep up with the news between episodes on our Facebook at facebook.com/BTBeltways, on Twitter at BTBeltways, and on our WordPress blog, betweenthebeltways.wordpress.com.
Copyright 2018, AOS 21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AOS 21 Media. What do you want your story to be?